TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Coronavirus, what is it and how do we prepare for it? With Dr. Michael Osterholm from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. In his book, Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs, Osterholm identified the most pressing infectious diseases of our day, and he laid out a 9-point strategy on how to address them, with preventing a global flu pandemic at the top of his list. On March 3, 2020, he defined the public health strategy that should and could have been followed. Dr. Michael Osterholm was interviewed by Peter Bergen, Vice President of Global Studies and Fellows, New America.
And thank you to Dr. Osterholm for doing this. He's a very busy guy right now, as you can imagine. We hosted him in 2017 for this amazing book, Deadliest Enemy. And basically, it predicts pretty much everything that's unfolded right now. Dr. Osterholm is one of the world's leading experts on infectious diseases. He's at the University of Minnesota. So Dr. Osterholm, the head of the World Health Organization last night said we're in uncharted territory. Is that a reasonable way of framing this?
It is relative to the conditions that we see in the world right now, meaning not just the cases of COVID-19 infection, but also in terms of just this global relationship we have with manufacturing, with supply chains, with transportation. And so even the 1918 pandemic didn't present those challenges that we see today with the combination of disease and economic, social, and political conditions in the world.
We've had other coronaviruses, which you worked on extensively, like SARS and MERS. I mean, what's the difference between this coronavirus and those coronaviruses, which, although they were highly problematic, didn't really kill very many people, relatively speaking?
Yeah, well, let me just take a step back. I think this might help set the table for this discussion. We have quite convincing evidence right now that this virus emerged in the Wuhan area in about the third week of November. And we can actually tell from the genetics of the virus that that, in fact, is the case because we can predict the kinds of changes that occur over time. And I'll come back to that later. Why that's important is because it sets up our understanding of where we're at right now. Note that the epidemic wasn't even really identified in Wuhan until towards the end of December, even though, as I mentioned, it had likely jumped, and almost like potentially a lightning strike kind of jump from an animal to a human, and I do believe that's the case. I don't believe that there has been man-made interference, whether unintentional or intentional, in terms of the release of this organism. And the reason it took almost 5 to 6 weeks is because when we even think about infectious disease transmission, we often come back to that concept of R-naught, or how many people on average does someone transmit the virus to? And what we see with this one is it's probably about an R-naught of 2 to 2.5. It's surely dynamic. If you think of regular influenza, it's about 1.4. If you think about pandemic influenza, it tends to be about 1.8 people. So this is quite different. It took yet that number of weeks before it was detected because you go from 1 to 2, 2 to 4, 4 to 8, 8 to 16, 16 to 32. And we now know that probably about 80% of the infections are very mild, if not asymptomatic. And so before you could get that, you might say, tip of the iceberg to emerge, you had to actually build case numbers up during that time period. And then by the time it got detected in Wuhan in the end of December, we were now talking about big numbers going from 500 to 1,000 to 2,000 to 4,000. And these were occurring about every 6 to 7 days. So today what we have happening right now is that we are seeing this kind of transmission around the world that is occurring much like Wuhan did early on. The Chinese have clearly suppressed this activity there with the most, I would have to say, aggressive, if not, you might say, authoritarian efforts in terms of population movement, quarantine, and so forth. And I want to emphasize that I'm convinced that that activity is going to, in a sense, have a major resurgence once China releases some of these population control measures to get the economy back working. And so that from that standpoint, we really do have a challenge in terms of even there expecting to see this resurgence. The rest of the world got seeded after Wuhan. And so we had actually here at our center had put out a document that actually said the last week of January in that time, that it would be about 1 month and the rest of the world would pop. And the reason we mean that was is it would take that much time before case numbers would build up in other areas around the world, and that much of what we were doing to try to stop transmission from China was pretty much useless because, in fact, this is influenza virus-like transmission. It's not MERS or SARS, which gets me back to MERS and SARS. What's different here is the fact that SARS and MERS both, and I was very involved with both outbreak investigations. I've actually, again, was spending part of my time at the U.S. government at HHS during the SARS outbreak. With MERS, I've investigated outbreaks in the Arabian Peninsula, as well as having been at Samsung Medical Center in Seoul, Korea, when that outbreak happened in 2015. Their patients are most infectious day five or later. And it allowed us the opportunity to identify these patients early, get them into protective isolation, make sure that their R0, even though they're blowing virus out, is zero, meaning that you don't have transmission. And when we didn't do that, we had hospital outbreaks, and we quickly realized that that was going to be an important thing to stop. And then we could get a hold of the contacts and actually follow up with them. And if they started to develop symptoms, we had time to get them into protective isolation and make sure that they didn't get infected. So this is so different than MERS and SARS. Here, virus transmission is occurring early in illness, likely even before symptoms show up, similar to influenza. The other two coronaviruses, MERS and SARS, were ones we could stop. SARS obviously was stopped because we both got rid of the animal reservoir in the markets of the Guangdong province, primarily palm civets. We can't get rid of the animal reservoir in the Arabian Peninsula. Nobody's going to, you know, basically put down 1.5 million camels. And so there we're constantly dealing with, once a human gets infected, making sure that they don't transmit to others. So, but this one's a very, very different coronavirus. Think of this as an influenza pandemic caused by a coronavirus, and you're thinking about this in the right way.
What do you think the lethality rate is?
You know, first of all, it is variable from the standpoint of who's actually getting infected. Clearly, we know in China that being older and having underlying healthcare challenges, as well as being a male, actually were risk factors where up to 14 to 18% of that group that were dying from this infection. One of the challenges we have today is understanding that. Well, with men in China, smoking is still a very, very common habit. And so from that perspective, we think smoking played a big role in the increased risk, which we see with even influenza in our own country. One of the challenges we have today is this: when that moves into a new population, what is going to happen? You know, we saw in total about 2% of the cases of all of the COVID-19 illness is in kids or up to teenagers up to 19 years of age. So it's very rare there, and it just goes up as you get older. One of the things we're concerned about as this moves out into other parts of the world is one of the other risk factors we know for having this kind of response to this type of pneumonia, which we call acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS, is that also obesity plays a very key role in that. And so now that we're laying this out into parts of the world where obesity in itself is an epidemic problem, we think we could see a very different kind of case fatality rate than we're seeing in China that is less gender specific and could be something of real significance. At this point, it's not nearly like SARS, which is close to 10%. It's not nearly like MERS, which is 25 to 35%. But it is somewhere between seasonal flu in a bad year, which is 0.1%, and the 1918 pandemic, which, of course, preferentially it took out young adults, of 2.5 to 3%. So this is clearly in that range of what would be considered a severe influenza pandemic if this were the influenza virus.
So if in a regular year in the United States, the lethality rate of flu is 0.1%, you're saying that this is what?
20 to 30 times higher, easily could be.
And so if 0.1% kills between 30 and 60,000 in any given year in the United States, what are the implications in this case?
Well, as you are so good at asking questions, Peter, you ask and answer in such a great way. I mean, it's obvious that this is a very serious challenge. And I think that, you know, it was unfortunate that we had a number of public health people who early on when this happened kept trying to compare it to influenza in a way of saying, well, look, flu kills many more people in this country. This is a much bigger problem. What they hadn't understood was that they were just watching the opening scene of this particular corona winter, as I call it. And I think that in this regard, we can expect to see a large number of deaths moving forward. And we're going to see a lot of morbidity. One of the challenges we have with this illness is that when you do get sick, and the Chinese data, which again is the best we have, suggests that anywhere from 5 to 10% of people will get severe illness. Of those 5 to 10, this is where we come up with the 2.5% that die. But what's been challenging is these patients need intensive care medicine, and many of them don't die for 2 to 3 weeks after they've been hospitalized, after they're consuming health care. And in fact, the hallmark case that so many of us painfully remember was the young 34-year-old physician in China who really brought this to the public's awareness by having his email or his internet website basically taken down by the Chinese government when he posted on it that these cases were occurring. He died 3 weeks into his illness, and he actually took a selfie of himself the last week before he died and then continued to go downhill and eventually died. So one of the challenges we have here is these people do use a lot of health care, and that makes it even more of a problem relative to influenza in terms of how we're going to respond.
Well, that raises a question of, so there are obviously going to be a lot of people with pneumonia who don't die, but they're going to be coming into the hospitals. Are we equipped with the ICUs and the ventilators that to kind of deal with a large scale group of people coming in with these kinds of symptoms?
Absolutely not. And that's what we've been talking about. And actually, when I did the briefing that you very kindly noted at the beginning of this session in your facility there, addressing the book that I wrote, nothing's changed since I wrote that book in terms of better preparedness. We're not. Right now, today, in Minneapolis-St. Paul, every one of the beds that we use for ECMO, this very high-level heart-lung-type machine that is very helpful in terms of keeping people alive who have this illness, are filled. They're all filled. We have really no open beds as such, given that we are just coming off a rather moderate to severe flu season, and that has stretched things. On top of that, we have a number of hospitals right here in the state of Minnesota, as is nationwide, that right now have 5 to 10 days of personal protective equipment available for healthcare workers, and that's it. And they've been ordering and ordering and ordering, and it's all in back order because everybody wanted it all at once. And so we're, I think, very likely facing a crisis in terms of protecting our healthcare workers in the next several weeks in many parts of this country.
What can be done?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to utilize the health services we have in different ways, meaning we need to stop elective surgeries. Anybody who's not severely ill with something else clearly needs not to be hospitalized. We need to be preparing our pandemic plan to the point of now thinking through what would we do if we had a 20 to 30% jump in the number of hospitalizations we needed. Remember in Wuhan, we had a number of people there who were desperately ill, who needed hospital care, who couldn't get into a hospital. And although the numbers varied, it was clear and compelling that many people were dying at home, not in hospital, not because they didn't want to be there, they couldn't get in. We also have not yet fully understood the impact that this had on people who had heart attacks, people who had acute asthma attacks, things where they really had medical crises and couldn't get health care in China because the hospitals were overwhelmed with these cases. So I think we're going to run into the same situation here, and our job is going to be triaging this in a way that allows us to make sure that we do take care of the sickest patients. The next thing I think we're going to have to do is, of course, think about how we're going to protect our healthcare workers. We need solutions that are not ideal, but that may work. For example, rather than having one patient in one room where if you come in and out, you have to doff and don or take on or off the protective equipment. And we know that, for example, in many institutions, that'll average 20 to 25 times a day a healthcare worker will get out of a room. Well, what we may need to do is, with the right engineering, so we're making sure that from an airflow standpoint, we're not sending air to other parts of the hospital, but open up wards where everyone in the ward is infected, and therefore what you do is you don't go in and out of rooms and doff and don your equipment. You use it constantly for potentially much of a shift. And so there are things we can do that way, but we still have a great likelihood that we're going to face shortages, and we don't have good answers for that right now. What do we do? And we'll be reverting back to surgical masks as opposed to N95 respirators. Surgical masks, we know, are ineffective. There's well now an estimated 4,500 healthcare workers in China who have become infected, providing care. Many of those were early in the outbreak when it wasn't completely understood just how infectious this virus is. But there have been a number since that time, and a large part of it's been tied to the absence of adequate respiratory protection.
Are you saying that the N95 respirator is not available in any meaningful quantity?
It's not, and part of the problem is this is, when you asked me early on why, you know, is this different, you know, in the quote-unquote olden days, just a decade or two ago, when you were looking at storing or stockpiling equipment that you needed for your institution, you counted on it taking some time to arrive even after you ordered it. It may have been an order via by mail or a telephone call. Today, we just assume that when we go on our computers and we get onto a site and we put in an order for X something, that it will arrive the next day by FedEx. And unfortunately, far too much planning has been done making the assumption supply chains would be stable, that they could handle surge capacity or need, and they can't. And so manufacturers right now in North America are manufacturing as quickly as they can this equipment, but basically healthcare has been financially in rough shape here in this country, no healthcare organization has gone out and stockpiled lots and lots of protective equipment. They have always bought it on a just-in-time basis. And so now we're paying the price for that. Some have said, well, this is in part because it's all made in China. And there are many things for which we are heavily dependent on China, including our critical drugs we use in this country. But believe it or not, actually a fair amount of personal protective equipment actually is made right here in North America. But no matter, we can't catch up. And so, you know, if we had 6 to 12 months to get ready and people understood the severity of what we are facing, then we might have had enough on hand. But, you know, the estimates are right now that we are many, many fold below what we would need to reasonably get through this situation as we expect it might unfold.
In terms of respirators.
In terms of respirators and potentially some of the other protective equipment, goggles and so forth. So this is going to be a challenge. I wrote a piece in the Washington Post several weeks ago about protecting healthcare workers as our frontline activity because I believe, as goes our healthcare facilities, our hospitals, our long-term care facilities, goes the sense of how much the country believes that we are actually handling the situation. And when healthcare workers start dying and they get severely ill and they go from being care providers to someone needing care, and hospitals are not able to handle patients because of a reduced number of healthcare workers, I think that's when you run the risk of people losing complete confidence in what's happening. You know, and one area I worry desperately about is kind of a perfect storm, is we know today long-term care, which we have major needs here in this country for that, that there's been a challenge finding workers to work in long-term care. And if we overlap this virus with workers and the outbreak in Kirkland, Washington right now in the long-term care facility there is a classic example. If you take out most of the workers and you have sick patients, who takes care of them? And so I think this is going to be a huge challenge.
You saw the news about the million tests. Where will those tests happen? Where will those tests happen? I mean, what's the kind of test for the test, as it were? I mean, is it going to be geographically centered on where these outbreaks are or randomly?
We're going to see most, I think, state health departments clearly having the capacity to test in all 50 state health departments and at least 12 or 15 large city health departments. In addition, other medical centers are bringing on their own tests that they are very used to doing with PCR. These are the ones that will be applying for the additional emergency authorization to do that. So I think you're going to see a variety of different places. One of the challenges we had with the CDC problems with this test is when they first applied for emergency authorization use by the FDA requirements, that gave that test the only access for people to use a test to that particular CDC test. And the FDA has had to respond to that and basically relax that requirement and allow others to also apply for emergency authorization use. And so I think it's a combination of factors. We'll see much more in the way of public health laboratories. We will see much more in the private sector coming forward. And again, you know, it was a really very unfortunate situation. We didn't have the kind of testing here in this country that much of the rest of the world has enjoyed for at least 4 to 5 weeks.
And how do you grade the Trump administration on this?
Well, you know, I think it was, I'll say right now, a CDC. However, you know, it could have happened under anybody's administration, but there should have been a plan to deal with it when it happened. And there wasn't. And that's what I think frustrated the people out here in the field, is that we knew we had transmission ongoing. And that we, unfortunately, were, in a sense, reinforcing this almost, I call it, fantasy that we somehow had stopped transmission coming into this country. And what I have said multiple times over the past 6 weeks is all we did was fix 3 of the 5 screen doors on our submarine. So we've had ongoing transmission in this country. We should have had testing that could have picked it up. And while any organization can have a problem with a test like this, the fact that there was no plan B, C, or D is really unfortunate.
How does this unfold, and what's the kind of timeline here?
Well, you know, this outbreak, from our perspective, has really unfolded on time. And what I mean by that is, even the second week of January, it was very clear that this was no longer going to be a MERS or SARS-like situation with transmission. It was much more dynamic. Clearly, it was acting very much like a flu virus. And so we have a group here at the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy called the CINRAP Leadership Forum, which involves a number of organizations and companies that we advise on a routine basis. And we've actually been having daily update phone calls on what was going on, dating back to the second week of January. And at that time, we said, all bets are off. This is no longer a MERS or SARS-like situation. We're not going to control it. This is influenza, and it's going like transmission, and it's going to continue. By the end of January, we actually put out to this group that it was just a matter of about probably 4 to 6 weeks, and we're going to see this pop internationally. And it was going to happen in a big way as we went through the same kind of phenomena that we saw in Wuhan, where it took 5 to 6 weeks before it really, in fact, took hold. Well, you know, I said the earliest we're probably going to see this will be the last week of February, but then don't be surprised if you see many countries and where you have transmission. It'll be widespread, and it'll appear like it's brand new, when in fact it's been going on for generations, meaning of the virus transmission. So Iran, Italy, Korea, none of these surprised us. They were what you would predict. So when we go from 26 countries 14 days ago, and we're now up into the 70s, you know, this shouldn't have been a surprise. Much of it was more a detection issue than it was even brand new transmission. So for our country, we've been saying for some time, there is widespread transmission going on in this country right now. It's just being missed. And as soon as we have testing, we're going to see it. I was on a public television show last Friday night, knowing that certain states had received their test kits. They were going to begin testing. And I actually said on Friday night, you know, within the next 72 hours, I think you're going to see this thing pop in the United States. And we're going to see it in multiple locations. And in some locations, we're probably going to document extensive transmission without any knowledge of what had happened in Seattle. So I think that this is really playing out on time. So now where do we go from here? A couple things. This is a challenge in terms of where does it go by time. Let me make one point really clear, which I think has not received sufficient discussion. We keep hearing that this is going to die out with the spring warmer weather in the Northern Hemisphere, somehow as if we're the whole world. And part of that is based on what has happened with the MERS and SARS coronaviruses. And SARS in particular, which SARS ended in 2003 in June. But, you know, having been very involved with that outbreak situation, let me just say, you know, we first detected it in the quote-unquote non-Guangdong province area in February of 2003. And it took us some time, meaning at least a month and a half to 2 months, to really understand the epidemiology of what I described earlier, where transmission was occurring much later in the clinical course, and so that we could identify, isolate these people, we could work with their contacts, and also understand what the actual reservoir was in the Guangdong markets so that they could be eliminated, which was largely palm civets, and that really stopped the virus from pinging humans, and we just had to clean it up in the human population, which took until literally June. But it had nothing to do with the seasons at all. I've investigated outbreaks of MERS on the Arabian Peninsula, and I've stood outside of hospitals when it was 110 degrees, and inside was going a ravaging outbreak. I've seen transmission from camels year-round. There's nothing in the MERS literature. The outbreak in Samsung Medical Center, which was hundreds of cases in a hospital transmission, occurred in May to June of that year. So don't think that that means it. But let's just take a look at flu, even if we want to use that as a model, because that's what the other thing people do. They say, well, seasonal flu ends. Remember, yes, influenza is at its peak in the northern and southern hemispheres during their respective winters, but it circulates year-round in the tropics. We've never understood that. It's always in the tropics. And if you look at the last 10 influenza pandemics that have occurred over the past 250-some years, two started in the winter, three started in the spring, two started in the summer, and three started in the fall. In every case, the second or the big wave was always displaced by about 6 months. If you look at 2009 with H1N1, we knew that activity started there probably late February, early March. We picked it up in April, early April, and we had that initial peak of cases that occurred in April and May around the world. But the second big peak occurred in North America and in many parts of the world in mid-September to mid-October when it was still very warm. Again, displaced by 6 months. And if you go back and look at all the other pandemics, that'll happen in the same way. So there is no model here that says this is going to go away. If it does, it does. And, it's obviously a new phenomenon for us. But I would say we have to be prepared to see this run a course for at least months yet. The other thing that we have ahead of us, which is a challenge, is that with influenza, we know we have some natural protection in the population because of previous infections that were close by. In 2009, we had a relative absence of cases in those who were 65 or years of age and older. And if you look back, these were the same people that would have been younger adults and children that were still on the remnants of the actual 1918 virus that continued to circulate into the 1930s. So, they obviously still had some protection. We have no evidence of any protection with this coronavirus right now in the population. And so that to that extent, we have kind of a virgin territory here in terms of the number of people that might get infected. And so is it going to be like the typical seasonal flu year where 10 to 20% of the population gets infected? We don't know. It could be a lot more. That's why even when we talk about case fatality rate, if you have a disease that has a very high case fatality rate but only 100 people get it every year, that's not nearly the same significance as a disease that has a low case fatality rate of 1%, but a billion people get it. And so what we don't understand here is how this virus is going to interact in terms of the number of people infected on top of the case fatality rate. This is surely going to be, everything we have says it's going to be a lot worse than a bad seasonal flu year.
That was Dr. Michael Osterholm from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. He was interviewed by Peter Bergen, Vice President of Global Studies and Fellows, New America, on March 3, 2020. You can watch the full one-hour event on YouTube by searching for the title, Coronavirus, What Is It? And How Do We Prepare for It? You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.